It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at the latest in national politics, from the release of 3,000 of Hillary Clinton's State Department emails to what last week's Supreme Court rulings mean for the Republican Party.
First, after missing the deadline for getting a new state budget in place, Republican leadership in the state legislature announced the details of a budget deal today with votes possible in the near future.
Two of the most controversial elements of the budget, changes to the state's prevailing wage law and funding for a new Milwaukee Bucks arena, have been removed to be taken up separately at some point in the future. There are also some changes to transportation funding, which has been the other big sticking point for lawmakers. Is it all going to be enough to win lawmakers over, get the votes, get a budget in place?
Here with us now to take a closer look at today's proposed budget deal is Jason Stein, who covers state government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica. Good to be here.
So, Jason, fill in some of those gaps for us. What do we know specifically about that budget deal and its viability so far?
Well, I would only call it a budget deal on the transportation part. The Senate and Assembly Republicans did reach an agreement on lowering the amount of projects that are getting done and the amount of borrowing that's getting done to, you know, build roads and bridges in the state. On the other two elements, I really wouldn't call that a deal. I mean, I would just say that they're just being left out of the budget for now, and that they're trying, you know, Republican leaders are trying to get to a place where they can pass public financing for the Bucks arena and changes to the prevailing wage laws.
So taking away those two most contentious things, the Bucks arena deal and the prevailing wage law, although transportation was also pretty contentious, but taking out two of the big ones, mm-hmm. does that increase its chances quite a bit for reaching a deal and getting some movement?
On the budget?
On the budget.
Right. I think so. You know, Senator Fitzgerald made clear to me today that he doesn't have the votes for the budget bill. He made clear he didn't have the votes for any of those three things at this time. But, you know, they did have a deal to get the budget bill out of the Joint Finance Committee, where it's been stuck for about a month. And, you know, then you get down to the regular arm and leg twisting that always happens, you know, about this time every 2 years when leaders are trying to get a bill passed.
So transportation has been a major sticking point. Governor Walker wanting to borrow about $1.3 billion for roads, a number that a lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans were balking at. And so what do we have now in the form of that deal?
Right. So, and even there, it's interesting to say we still don't have the final plan. But what they've done is cutting. They want to cut at first. They want to provide $500 million in borrowing, and then there'd be an additional $350 million in state bonds that would be held back by the Joint Finance Committee, by the Budget Writing Committee. And if the Walker administration would have to come forward with a plan for using those remaining loan money to convince the Finance Committee to let them go out to the financial markets and borrow that money.
And there has already been debate about what would happen if some of that proposed highway bonding went away, and people saying, well, look, some of that money should probably then go to projects outside Milwaukee, which has made the zoo interchange more controversial. Where does that stand?
Okay, so the big fight has been whether or not to leave southeastern Wisconsin, the big mega projects in the Milwaukee area, leave them completely alone and make the cuts in other places in Wisconsin, or to, you know, share that pain more between those two parts of the state. You know, they kind of, I would say they split the baby somewhat on that. The zoo interchange, which brings together I-94 and 894 and Highway 45, it's the busiest interchange in the state. That one will, all the work that's being done right now on that will be completed, but a coming phase on the north side of that interchange that deals with Highway 45, that is going to be delayed. And then you're going to see, you know, other projects that are going to be delayed or cut in other parts of Wisconsin.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, getting the latest on the state budget and looking at one of the aspects of the budget that had been a sticking point. Again, the Bucks Arena package is now out of the state's budget. Does that mean that lawmakers are acknowledging that there's a lot more heavy lifting to be done on this, and that maybe the arena deal and the state budget stand a better chance if those are decoupled?
Right. I mean, basically what happened is there was an attempt by the governor and Republican leaders in the legislature to pass that Bucks deal as part of the state budget, which, I mean, essentially means you're going to do it with only Republican votes, because in the modern era here of politics, you just don't have lawmakers from one party voting for the other party's budget. Doesn't happen. As they've been going through this process, they've realized that, no, that's not doable for us. We need some Democratic votes to get this passed. So they're choosing to break it out of the budget in the hopes that they can convince several Democratic senators, at least, to vote for the bill and give a pass to, you know, then several Republican senators who could vote against it.
You hearing any names about Milwaukee Democrats maybe who might be willing to vote for that deal?
I'm hearing many names. I'm hearing several names. But I think at this point, what we can say is that Senators Lena Taylor, Nikia Harris-Dodd, and Chris Larson of Milwaukee have all expressed some openness to the idea of voting for the Bucks proposal, but said that they, you know, need to have a lot more details and need to be at the table with Republicans before they'd be willing to do that. Senator Tim Carpenter of Milwaukee has been much more critical of the deal, and I don't want to say that he will absolutely not vote for it, but that's certainly been the sentiment that he's been expressing, you know, or that he did express a couple weeks back.
Looking next at prevailing wage. Now, why was that one taken out?
That one, again, is one that's been tying Republicans in knots, particularly in the state Senate. There you have a couple senators who are conservative senators who are saying, look, we need these state laws at least completely repealed, at least for local governments like schools and municipalities. We need those off the books, or we will not vote for the state budget. And then you have a couple of other more moderate, or, you know, just mainline conservative Republicans, rather, who are saying, if you completely repeal a prevailing wage, we won't vote for that. So, you know, given how tight the votes are in the Senate, that's made it difficult for Republican leaders to find a path to passing the budget. So there's an attempt to break that issue out of the budget and solve it. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a heavy lift for them either way.
So we've got these big changes announced today. We've got Bucks and prevailing wage gone from the state budget. We've got a change of sorts for transportation with a reduced amount of borrowing on the table. What happens next?
That's great. I mean, I think, again, sometimes you need sources and sometimes you need psychics as a reporter. And so I can't, you know, I think that we're going to see a lot of movement next week. Tomorrow we know that the legislature's budget committee is going to come in. My expectation would be that as we've been told, it'll be passed by that committee. You know, they'll take the votes that we've talked about. There's always a surprise motion with lots of goodies that comes out. There'll be one of those too. And then, you know, next week, there's going to be a lot of wheeling and dealing.
Now, looking way ahead to when the legislature finally signs off on this budget, the bill goes to Governor Walker, who's got partial veto power. Does anybody know what he might be thinking about in terms of things that may or may not get vetoed?
Oh, that's a great question. I asked Speaker Robin Voss about this today, and he told me that Republican lawmakers did not have any kind of advance deal with the governor over what he would and would not veto. Sometimes that will happen between lawmakers and a governor of the same party. He says it has not. You know, as the governor considers running for president, he may very well be looking for a way that he could grab some headlines with his very powerful partial veto pen. But, you know, right now, he has certainly said that he would veto certain things if they were in the budget, but for that reason, Republican lawmakers have not put them in. So I think it's an open question about what he might veto of what they have actually done.
Jason, thanks a lot for catching us up.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Jason Stein of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the budget changes announced today.
We head to Washington for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Last week, a big one for the Obama administration and Democrats in general, with major rulings from the Supreme Court. Now, as we look to next year, how will the GOP talk about issues like same-sex marriage and the Affordable Care Act?
Last night, the State Department released its first round of Hillary Clinton's emails sent and received through her private server while Secretary of State. Also in presidential news, Chris Christie announced yesterday that he's in for 2016, bringing the total number of Republican candidates to 14 and counting.
Here with us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Joins us each Wednesday at this time for a no-holds-barred look at the week's political news. Harry, good to have you back.
Great to be back.
Let's start with the Supreme Court, because they really were hogging the headlines for a while there. Affordable Care Act still intact, same-sex marriage now legal in all states. So what does this mean for Republicans in the presidential race? How do they navigate these issues?
Well, I think that both issues are going to be dealt with separately. We'll start with same-sex marriage. This is going to be an issue where I'm not sure where Republicans are going to line up exactly. You've already seen a split between the Republicans who are the more centrist, those who are looking ahead towards the general election, like Jeb Bush, who are essentially saying, look, the ruling has been made, and we're going to follow the ruling, respect the ruling, even if we disagree with the ruling, and we're going to make sure that religious institutions are protected so that they don't have to marry people that they don't necessarily want to marry. And then you have other Republicans, those who are, let's say, more to the right, who are playing to evangelical Christians, who are saying that this is one of the worst rulings ever, and we need to pass a constitutional amendment in order to allow states to opt out of same-sex marriage. You see that among people like Mike Huckabee and Ted Cruz, and even Governor Walker has been pretty harsh in terms of his views of same-sex marriage.
And Harry, you broke down some numbers on this in a recent piece, a concern for Republicans that if they go with that second approach, more opposition to same-sex marriage possibly could get them into some trouble in the general election.
Yeah, so in my piece, what I essentially did was I looked at, you know, how people decided whether they're going to be a Democrat or a Republican, and looked at the different issues that were more highly correlated with that ultimate decision. And as it turns out, same-sex marriage, although most people will say, oh, it's not that important of an issue, it may in fact be a gateway issue into sort of saying, hey, look, if the Republicans are against same-sex marriage, then there's just no way I'm ever going to look at them. And indeed, what the numbers showed was it was a very, very high up. And given that the country is moving towards more and more acceptance of same-sex marriage, I think the most recent polls has it in the high 50s to low 60s, that's not a position, being against same-sex marriage, that you want to hold if you are a Republican nominee, because you could be alienating voters who might otherwise be able to give you a look and potentially give you their vote for president.
So you're thinking there are some voters out there who will say, while they might support same-sex marriage, they're not going to vote solely based on that, but they might see this as a marker, an indicator for a wider worldview.
That's exactly right. You know, if you talk with younger people, and I talk with younger people because I am a young person. I'd like to think I have some friends my own age. And if you talk with them, you know, they will very rarely ever say, oh, the reason why I'm a Democrat is because I want to save the social safety net. No, that's not really what's going on. It's more of a cultural thing. And it's issues like same-sex marriage, which overwhelming majorities of young people support, that they're looking at Republicans saying, look, they're the party of yesteryear. We don't want to support them. And if Republicans continue on the pathway of saying, you know, basically disregarding, you know, same-sex marriage and saying, oh, we want nothing to do with that, it's disgusting, it's not a good thing for them going forward.
Let's turn to that other big Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, effectively keeping subsidies in place for a number of states, including Wisconsin. Republicans probably not going to turn around and support the Affordable Care Act for the most part, I'm guessing. But how does that affect their Republican or the presidential field, if at all?
Well, I think this is almost the, you know, even though Obama and the Democrats won the policy, politically the Republican presidential candidates are very happy about this. Because if the subsidies did go away, there really wasn't much of a plan B for Republicans, at least at this point. They haven't developed an alternative to Obamacare. And this gives them time to do that. And more than that, it's always easier to be the opposition and complain than actually to pass legislation. So if you're a Republican candidate right now, you heard all of them pretty much come out against this ruling and say that this is terrible. Ted Cruz called it as part of the worst 24 hours in our country's history. And so you're just going to see Republicans say over and over again, you know, we need to overturn Obamacare. We need an alternative. And over the next year and a half, if a Republican does win, maybe they will come up with a very full-fledged alternative. And if they get in the office, they'll try and pass it. Passing legislation is always easier than talking about legislation, but Republicans are going to get plenty of mileage out of this.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538, our weekly look at national politics. Let's go to the other side of the presidential race. Hillary Clinton, last night the State Department released the first round of emails that she sent on her private server while Secretary of State, about 3,000 of them, I guess, released last night, 9 p.m. for some reason. What have we seen, anything that's really catching people's attention here?
She had trouble with a fax machine. I think that was the thing that caught most people's attention. There really wasn't much here in this set of emails that were really all that controversial. It was a lot of personal correspondence. I think she spoke with Colin Powell about a bone that she broke. She spoke with John Podesta about wearing socks to keep his feet warm. This was just typical personal correspondence that we would normally see. And remember, the Clinton camp has to release these emails every 30 days, and so that's why you sort of saw this weird release at a weird hour, because it's just taking a lot of time for them to be able to cobble all these emails together and then be able to release them. They're ordered to do so by a district court. So there wasn't a heck of a lot there, but that doesn't mean there won't be something there the next month. It just so happens that sometimes television episodes or political episodes aren't all that exciting. Stay tuned, though.
Yeah, is there a sense that, or a hope, I guess, among our opponents and maybe media who want to get something more interesting out of this, that there is more red meat in future releases?
Sure. I mean, look, when it comes to the Clintons and the press, the press is always going to be interested in the Clintons and hoping that there's red meat. And obviously Republicans as well are hoping that there's red meat. I'm sure there's going to be something that's going to come out that will intrigue both or either Republicans or the press. But, you know, look, the Clintons have been in the public eye for well over 20 years now, and they haven't been torn down yet. My guess is Hillary Clinton wasn't dumb enough to put something in an email that could take her down, but I've been proven wrong before, so why not again?
And some people have said, hey, this is showing a lighter side, a human side of Hillary Clinton. Is this release, to the extent that it matters at all, good for her?
I mean, you know, we're a year and a half away from the, you know, the actual presidential election, so I don't think most people are really going to be keeping their eye on it. But for, you know, people like you and me who are really into politics, sure, it does show a lighter side. It certainly doesn't hurt her.
All right, Chris Christie now in the race this week, joining the growing roster of Republican candidates. Once upon a time, viewed as a front runner, a lot of positives for a Republican nomination to win the whole deal. Things have changed. What happened?
I mean, Bridgegate is essentially what happened for him. You know, if you go back to 2013 and you look at his reelection in the state of New Jersey, which Mitt Romney nearly lost by 20 points, Chris Christie won that state by nearly 20 points, and he won with Latinos, which are a huge group that Republicans want to break in with. He had great favorable ratings from Democrats and independents nationwide. He had the electability argument, which is huge when your party has been out of the White House for two terms. The last thing Republicans want, it's the worst nightmare of all time that Hillary Clinton wins the presidency. So Republicans were willing to look past a fairly moderate record that Chris Christie had, and he was leading in most of the primary polls 2 years ago. But then Bridgegate happened, and his numbers with Democrats, independents plummeted overnight. He has not led in a single general election poll since the beginning of 2014, And once he didn't have the electability argument, why would you vote for a candidate who's both too moderate for you and isn't electable? It's just not a winning combination for Chris Christie in a Republican primary.
Well, one other big announcement that we're watching for, Scott Walker, Wisconsin governor, he has said he's going to announce a couple weeks, July 13th. Now, polling in Iowa, and this is a ways off, these are early polls, he has slipped a little. He was in the 21 to 25% range in Iowa, down to 18% now, but still out ahead of the field. Is this little slippage something he should worry about?
I'm not particularly concerned if I'm Scott Walker, and the reason is if you look at the underlying numbers, the percentage of Republicans who say they have a favorable view of him has not changed, and if anything, has gone up. We have more candidates in the race now. Donald Trump has entered. He's taking up a little bit of the spotlight, chewing up a few percentages, and, you know, he won't be a real factor when it comes down the road. So if I'm Walker, I'm not too worried about it. He does need to win in Iowa, though. Make no mistake about it. That is a key state. It's right near Wisconsin. It's a state that plays well to Walker's conservative brand. If he does not win in Wisconsin, win in Iowa, he's in big, big trouble. But for now, he's ahead, and he's clearly ahead, and pretty much every single poll has had him ahead since February. So I'm not worried.
We'll talk about this another time or two, I'm sure, Harry. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us each week at this time for a look at the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Around this time every year, a heated debate breaks out among music fans. Just what is the biggest song of the summer?
Some years that answer is clear. No one's going to argue with Carly Rae Jepsen's Call Me Maybe or Daft Punk's Get Lucky. That's playing in the background right now. Other years, not so clear cut. Either way, the idea of being the song of the summer is something that's been important to songwriters and performers and the recording industry as a whole.
But where did the concept of the summer song come from? You might think it stems from the golden age of rock and roll in the 50s and 60s, but our next guest says it's a concept that goes back even further.
Phil Edwards is with us now. He's a correspondent at Vox, where he recently looked into the history of the summer song. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So music obviously been around a long time, but commercial music, maybe a more recent phenomenon. So how do we figure out when the concept of the summer song first came about?
Yeah, so I think I was probably like most people in that I thought of the summer song as being totally attached to surfboards and convertibles and stuff from the 60s like that. But it turns out that it's actually a lot older than you might think it is. So basically what I tried to research is when does this concept of a summer song come up? And very early on, you have printed music that's circulating the country and is definitely very popular, but the cycle for these songs is much longer than a single season. So you might have stuff like Stephen Foster, who has very popular songs, but that's over the course of a number of years. There were popular songs like these that went back even to the early 1800s. I found one song, and I have to say the title, called The Old Oaken Bucket, that apparently was the big hit in 1817. But it wasn't isolated to the summer. However, that kind of changed when Tin Pan Alley and music publishing got involved, and suddenly you had a faster cycle for these songs, and that meant that there could be an actual hit that was isolated to the summer and that people associated with it.
Are there certain qualities that a summer song has to have to be considered a great summer song, other than, you know, just happening to be released in the summertime?
Yeah, so I found some of the quotes from these old summer songs to be totally prescient and exactly define what I look for in a summer song today. I found one quote from 1910 in which people were speculating about a summer song, and somebody said, "What will it be this season? Will it be humorous? Will it be sentimental? Will it be unmitigated trash? Will it be at least bearable in text or music, or both?" So from the beginning, people sort of had this mixed relationship with the summer song where they loved it, but they also felt a bit of contempt for it, which I had flashbacks to hearing Get Lucky. You know, I loved that song in the beginning, and then now that I've heard it 1,000 times, I start to think, oh my gosh, why can't we move on to the next thing? So I think that earworm element was always something that people identified. I also found another really funny example from the early 1900s in which one person who was skeptical of the summer song said, it is the song that the drunk is going to sing that is the song that is going to be popular.
Does that hold true?
That nailed it, I think. That's,
I mean, that's totally right on. And people were just definitely imagining these beer hall songs. That was the image that was evoked in these early eras where beer gardens are opening up. People have a pint in one hand, and the other hand, they have their arm around somebody as they sway to whatever the hot song is that season.
Well, I want to check out one of the hot songs that you referred to in your piece. This is one, 1909, called My Wife Has Gone to the Country, Hooray, Hooray.
She's gone to the country, hooray, hooray. She's 45, I need the rest, and why she went away. Think of the children with her, hooray, hooray. I don't care what she comes to see, my wife's gone away.
So it's no old oaken bucket. But can you tell us about that and some of the other early summer hits that stood the test of time or not?
Yeah. So you have to love the subtlety of the titles in these.
Right.
I mean, our pop music is crude, but the titles are at least a little more elusive and a little vaguer. These ones just really hit the nail right on the head. So in addition to My Wife's Gone to the Country, Hooray, Hooray, there was also a song called McGinty, Elsie from Chelsea, and Where Did You Get That Hat that lit up the charts in the 1900s. Just the idea of a whole song about hats is just so perfectly fitting for 1910 that, you know, you couldn't make up anything better.
Yeah.
And then around the same time, people were speculating, too, about what the big song would be the next summer. And they had some pretty good predictions for that, too. They would say, oh, it's going to be some big song about Teddy Roosevelt that's going to have everybody across the country singing. Or maybe it'll be something about Halley's Comet, which is at the same time. So they had these ideas for songs that might be topical that would come up, that would get into people's mind, or something that would really epitomize what people were thinking about at the time.
We're talking to Phil Edwards, correspondent at Vox. We're talking about the history of the big summer song. And Phil, you say it really started with sheet music, but technology changed, recording technology changed. Did that speed up the cycle and maybe put more at stake on having that big hit of the summer?
Yeah, I think so, because you have sheet music circulating, and so you have this very long period in which a summer song can exist or be popular. But then in the 1900s, phonographs start to get more popular. They start to become something that you might have in your house. And suddenly the charts are actually more accurate because they're recording songs sold. So then later on in the 20s, you have really big sales for these records that puts pressure both on people who are interested in knowing about the hot new thing and publishers who are interested in selling the hot new thing to figure out what the big song will be. So by the 1920s, you already had the New York Times saying that they were nostalgic for the songs of yesterday that symbolized the olden times, and it only escalated from there. Billboard was around actually pretty early, but by 1936, they were publishing their first hit parade, and then later in the 50s, they published the Hot 100, and so from there, the summer song became more of a commodity and less of just a feeling that was floating in the air.
So it seems like we've come a long way from Where Did You Get That Hat? These songs are really, thankfully, I think, songs have become a little different now, these summer hits. Are there complaints, though, that these are too vapid, they get stuck in your head, they're not sophisticated enough? Is this a hallmark of a summer song, that it can be kind of empty and poppy?
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it, but I think it's also that it's really addictive. I think you could look at the Gotye song that was around a couple of summers ago, somebody I used to know, and that was a song that was very addictive. You couldn't get it out of your head. You were hearing it everywhere. But if you think about the song itself, it's actually a little depressing. So I think that the one thing you can't get rid of is that it needs to be incredibly catchy and impossible to forget. For me personally, it does have to be a little happier. It has to be a little more enjoyable. And it has to have sort of a sweaty sheen on it, you know, the same way that most of us do during the summer. But ironically, the one thing that I did find when I was looking over these summer songs was that they don't have to necessarily be released in the summer. They just have to get big in the summer. So my personal summer song is No Scrubs by TLC.
Ah.
And I was very disheartened to learn when I was looking this up that it was released in January. But regardless, it's still the summer song to me because that's when it popped big and that's when it really took over the country.
What about something like Boys of Summer? That seems like such a summer song to me, but it doesn't pass your benchmark because it's kind of, I don't know, depressing.
Down, yeah.
He doesn't get the girl. He's driving. He's stalking her. He's driving by her house.
Oh, Dynamite.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if it provides a strong emotional reaction, that's still going to give you some qualification, and if it's catchy, and I will provide you with a loophole saying that if it has the word summer in it, it's probably allowed to be the song of summer.
Now, what about, you mentioned earlier that a lot of people immediately go to the beach and, you know, Beach Boys and Jan and Dean for summer type songs. Was that the 60s, maybe early 60s, mid 60s, a golden age for summer songs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable to say that it was just because in 1958, as I mentioned, you had the Billboard Hot 100 debut. So that suddenly makes these summer songs calculable in a way that they weren't before. It's not just in the air. It's something that's printed on a piece of paper, and you can watch those singles float up and down the chart. And then I think in turn with that, you have the rise of the car and California culture. So that definitely makes it a strong argument that it's a golden age for these songs, even though they were around a long time before.
Well, now you've got a music industry that's struggling, and people like to buy a lot of their music a la carte, just a song at a time, and full albums aren't as much of a thing as they used to be. So does that make summer hits more or less important?
Yeah, I almost think that maybe they maintain their importance even in this age because they're the one thing that we can kind of unify around. We may not all be buying the same album. We may not all be buying a whole album at all, but we are sort of inundated with this one big song. And so I think that might be part of the reason that people still search for this iconic summer song, because it gives a certain concrete feel or even just an emotion to the summer that it's harder to get these days.
Before we let you go, Phil, you mentioned No Scrubs. Can you leave us with another of your favorite summer jams, one you've got to listen to during the summer?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, that's my big one. That's the one where I was working as a paper boy, and I remember sweatily hearing it through the car window. So I'm gonna stick with that for sure. And then, of course, you know, any song with summer in it, so I'd be bad if I didn't say LFO's Summer Girls, though I refuse to personally endorse it.
All right, Phil, been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Vox correspondent Phil Edwards joining us to talk about the history of the summer song.
And now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your all-time favorite summer song? Picture it. You're cruising to the beach, convertible, top down. What song is it you're listening to on the radio? And if you've got a pick for the song of this summer, what is it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your pick on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, East Coast girls are hit by really dig those styles they wear. And the Southern girls with the way they talk, they knock me out when I'm down there. The Midwest.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking summer songs right now, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What song just screams summer to you? Is it a jam from the past, or is it a more recent pop hit? And if you've got a candidate for Song of the Summer 2015, what is it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Already heard from Marsha on Facebook. She lists Boys of Summer, one of your favorites, Veronica, Beach Baby, and anything by the Beach Boys, especially California Girls, you just heard there. And she says, I'll stop because this could be a very long list.
We're going to go to our callers right now. We've got Leanne on the line in Racine. Leanne, hi.
Hi.
What is your pick for summer song?
Blast from the Past. It's Summer in the City.
Ah, back of my neck, getting sweaty and gritty.
So it
passes,
yep.
Dirty and Gritty passes the sweaty, sort of dirty summer test that we heard about.
Yeah, so. It's not an all happy song, though, because it's talking in a way about how it's gross to be hot during the day in the summer in the city. But the nighttime is a little better. So you're not that doesn't bring you down, Leanne?
Oh, no.
It's a great song, though.
Yeah. Part of the summer.
And I love the instrumental lead into. Yeah. Okay, maybe I won't recreate the.
I'm gazing.
Oh, but I know some of the ones coming up, I might have to sing the guitar parts.
Well, thanks for that call.
Thanks, Leanne. We'll go next to Chris with us in Madison with a summer song. Chris, hi.
Best of all time, I have to say, is Panama by Van Halen.
Yeah, that is a good one. And I couldn't come up with one, but I was thinking, okay, something to rock out to, window down in the car. Is that where you envision yourself hearing Panama in the summer?
Absolutely. Either that or Roy Orbison, Pretty Girl, also a Van Halen cover.
Pretty Woman, yeah, okay. So Van Halen, Woman, yeah. you'll keep coming back to Van Halen this summer?
Every dime.
Chris, thanks a lot. Yeah, Panama, I can definitely see.
Panama, pretty Woman, actually, also. And for some reason, I'm thinking Brown Eyed Girl. Does that seem like a summer song?
Oh,
if
totally.
I can interrupt
down
your air
hall.
Jam
yeah,
over
so
there.
Yeah, so I was air guitaring the beginning of Panama that time, to spare you.
Anyway, Brown Eyed Girl.
Yeah, definitely. Think? Yeah, it's all about summertime frolicking,
Those are
I believe.
Older songs. Well, yeah. Anyway, thank you for that call. We're going to go next to Terry in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Terry.
Hi, well, actually, I'm from St. Paul, but I'm driving through your fair state with a headset in, I might add.
Welcome, welcome.
And thank you for taking my call. I have to say, Under the Boardwalk would be my all-time favorite. But it's really hard to put an all-time favorite on summer songs. All that you've mentioned so far are just wonderful as well. I think we should maybe look for a compilation of favorite summer songs instead.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Definitely.
Well, and Under the Boardwalk, yeah, that's classic. It's hard to argue with that. You got a boardwalk, you've got the sea, other things.
Yeah,
in the song
there's a beach
summer.
There, presumably.
There's a beach, yeah,
activities outside. But it's also a nice groove to the song too. It's not as straight ahead hard rocking or like beachy, you know, Beach Boys type thing. Yeah, great suggestion. Thanks so much. We are taking your calls for the greatest go to summer song of all time for you. The one you want to hear, the one that makes you think of summer, maybe has a memory attached to it, maybe a brand new song that you think is the big song of this summer. The compilation's a good idea. I know Amanda Magnus, our producer, has multiple, I think she said, playlists for summer.
Oh, that's a great idea.
She's
We're
very
gonna
organized.
Have to ask her about some of those later on. But to get you inspired, here's one. It's called Summertime by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. 'Cause it's summertime.
And what that Fresh Prince guy, he had talent. What's he up to nowadays?
We're talking about Will Smith,
it's Will Smith
here, right?
I know, I'm just funning you.
I think that's what he's up to, being Will Smith and raising some interesting kids.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's a good one. Let's go next to Brandon in Madison. Brandon, hi.
Hey.
What is your pick?
I'm going 90s West Coast. I'm going Coolio's Fantastic Voyage.
I can't Coolio. Place that one. Sing us some. Anybody.
Keep it clean, though.
Rob, is it? Should we not sing
Coolio,
it out loud?
There are All moments.
Right. All right, so.
Fantastic Voyage by Coolio. Brandon, why is that your summer song?
It was a huge hit back in probably the late 90s, back in the high school days when we'd head to the beach pretty much every day during the summer.
All right, and thank you, Brandon, for that. And I think that's going to be a big part for people, the song that when you were in high school in the summer. And one that popped in my head was The Outfield. I Don't Want to Lose Your Love Tonight,
right.
Whatever that song's actually called. Like, I just remember, you know, tooling around Main Street, Belleville, Michigan with my friend, you know, listening to that in the car.
For sure. And actually, I think that stands up. That's still a really good song.
I mean, maybe in the right mood.
Come on. All right. Thanks for that. Larry. Larry is next to Nina. Hi.
Well, hello. My favorite summertime song was not a hit, but it was from the 70s. It's by the Allman Brothers, and it's called The Blue Sky.
The Blue Sky. Well, the title is evocative. Rob, do you know that one?
I don't know it. My Allman Brothers, I pretty much only know the hits. Why is that a summer one for you, Larry?
Because it is just kind of all about summer. I mean, blue sky, walking down the river, and stuff like that.
Fantastic, Larry. Thank you so much. That's good. Yeah, I mean, definitely the lyrics can evoke a big part of the summer in some of these songs.
For some reason, that made me think of the Bruce Hornsby song, End of the Innocence, which I despise, but which reminds me of summer.
Okay. Okay, but it's not. It will not go to the top of your summer.
It's not
going to
be on my playlist, but it does make me think of summer.
Okay,
all right,
and hate summer for it.
Hateful summer feelings. Yes, Larry, thanks a lot for that one, and we're going to go to Gary in Wausau. Gary, hello.
Hey, hi guys. So, yeah, boy, you really inspired me to think here. I've actually had one. It was the Beach Boys always remind me of summer, and I was thinking Brian Wilson's Bernadette.
Ah, so Beach Boys pedigree, you got that going for
great,
you.
Yeah, great harmonies. And then I guess my little heavier one would be Scorpions, Rock You Like a Hurricane.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? That's a really
good
one.
I'm doing it again. I'm doing guitar
riffs.
That's
a really good one. I also agree with that one, Gary.
Yeah, the hard to go wrong with Rock You Like a Hurricane. Thank you so much. Yeah, Beach Boys, I'd probably go Good Vibrations. Like, I'm not always in the mood for Beach Boys, but if I am, that's probably the song I'm going to want to hear.
Beach Boys is almost too easy, though.
Yeah,
right? Because
that's true.
They're the Beach Boys.
But I don't know. I'll accept that. If that's your summer song, that's your summer song.
Completely reasonable, but yeah. Okay. Almost everything by the Beach Boys, I think, evokes summer.
All right, back to our callers. Thanks, Gary. We've got Tony on the line in Madison with a summer song. Tony, hi.
Hi. How about Summer Breeze? Summer Breeze makes me feel...
I think we have... Yeah, we have that. Seals and Croft. Let's give a listen.
Summer Breeze.
Tony, thanks a lot for that one, Summer Breeze. And that's another one of those lazy summer songs, I guess I'd say. Right,
not the rockin' genre, but the chill out, it's summertime.
Yeah, there's a version of Up a Lazy River by Zoot Sims, a sax player, very mellow. That would probably be my lazy summer song, just like guitar and saxophone.
And I kind of go for Santana Smooth.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, it starts with it being a hot day. I like that one.
All right, well, thank you so much for all of your calls, comments, and suggestions. You can keep them going, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your favorite, your go-to song for the summer season. There's a hidden battle going on in kitchens around the nation over how to properly load a dishwasher. A new Wall Street Journal article digs into the household drama over the right and wrong ways to load the dishes.
And it turns out the appliance industry is trying to figure out how couples are fighting over the proper use of their products. A survey by the company Bosch found that 40% of Americans surveyed, quite a lot, say they argue about the right technique.
And I guess there are some stealth battles out there, too, where, you know, a husband or wife will secretly come back later and reload the dishwasher for practical or aesthetic reasons after their spouse has already loaded it. Is this a thing for you?
I totally think there's a right and a wrong way, and I have been known to not so stealthily reload. Maybe not the whole thing, but, you know, kind of get your most capacity that you can out of your dishwasher.
I used to do that more, even after I'd loaded it. But then I'm like, okay, I just took more time to fit in one more dish than it would have taken me just to wash the dish by hand and run the thing.
Martha Stewart thinks there is a right and a wrong way.
Well,
okay.
She thinks
Martha
that about everything.
Martha Stewart would think that. But if Martha thinks it, maybe there's something to there being a right and a wrong way.
My key technique is we have these lethally sharp forks, so I have to have them on the other side of the thing so I don't repeatedly jam my finger onto them. And you remember when I used to come in with bandages on my fingers?
And that's
all the
another
time.
Point of contention. Do you load the knives and the forks
handle
point down or up?
I do them up.
You put
it's
the
easier
pointy
to fit.
Part up?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well,
because
no. Well, anyway.
All right, we continue.
Stick around. There are more noteworthy topics coming up here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Stay tuned.